Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, it's Emmett here. Before we start today's podcast, I'm excited to announce our first ever Stock Club live podcast, which will be taking place in Dublin's Herbert Park Hotel on November 23rd, so just under 3 weeks away. I'll be joined on the night by Anne-Marie, Rory and Mike to talk about what we all learned in the brutal year that has been 2022 and to share some of our bold predictions and favourite stocks for 2023. We'll be making a full announcement about this next week, but we're giving our loyal Stock Club listeners the first opportunity to get tickets, which are limited to just 100. Tickets are available right now through the link in the description at a price of €20 each, which includes a couple of free drinks at the bar. It should be a great night and one I'm really looking forward to, so any listeners in Dublin or the surrounding area, don't miss out. And for anyone listening from further afield, don't worry, we'll be planning more Stock Club live events in 2023 outside of Dublin and even outside of Ireland. So watch this space.
Hi there and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. This week, we're bringing you another interview with one of the leading minds in the world of technology and stock investing. Brett Winton holds the very enviable title of Chief Futurist at ARK Invest. As Chief Futurist, Brett drives ARK's long-term forecasts across convergent technologies, economies and asset classes, helping ARK to forecast the impact of disruptive innovation on public and private equities. A few weeks ago, Emmett sat down with Brett to chat about the future and what it might hold in terms of technological innovation. Of course, Emmett also managed to get Brett's five favourite stock picks at the moment, a couple of which are already in the Horizon portfolio. Normal service will resume at Stock Club next week, but for now, sit back and let Emmett and Brett take you to the not-so-distant future.
Brett Winton, Chief Futurist at ARK Invest, welcome to Stock Club. I'm particularly excited about this conversation, but before we dive into all things future, could you spend a few minutes on your past and tell me about your professional journey to this point?
Sure. I'm educated as a mechanical engineer at MIT. And after, you know, a series of unfortunate events, including doing business development in the RFID space, I ended up operating in what was kind of a internal think tank inside a large fund manager, Alliance Bernstein. And so that was called Research on Strategic Change, and did projects on carbon dioxide regulation and reformation of financial services. So big structural changes, many of them technology inflected that cut across sectors. And then from 2014, I've been directing the research team at ARK Invest and am now the chief futurist. That I've worked with Cathie Wood, the CEO and CIO for 15 years now. And always looking at how the world is going to transform over a medium-term forward basis. So 5 years forward, what is going to be kind of the thing that becomes the thing that drives kind of markets, economic activity, and changes the world? And so that's where I am today.
That's very cool. I mean, the title Chief Futurist is about as cool as it gets. What do your responsibilities entail day to day and week to week?
Well, I think that successfully forecasting the future is more important to markets than it's ever been. You know, across all of the technology platforms that we focus on, it's clear that the rate pace of change is picking up. You know, if you follow the AI space at all, it's almost hard to fathom the degree of advances on a week-to-week basis in terms of state-of-the-art models and breakthroughs in terms of capability. And what that means is that kind of like having a good medium term forecast is going to infect the underlying, infect or affect, you know, potentially infect incumbents and affect companies that are leveraged to these disruptive technologies in the marketplace more quickly. And so from the beginning at ARK, we focused on, you know, how can we quantify and dimension, you know, the likely 5-year forward trajectory of markets and technologies. And as chief futurist, I guide those forecasts, look at how kind of the technology forecasts then are, make sure that they're mutually consistent with each other, and dimension how kind of like the compounding nature of technology is going to impact not just the public equity space, but venture, private equity, you know, real estate and fixed income as well.
Amazing. Actually, back in my physics days, I specialized in chaotic mathematics, which sounds like it should have an application. I still haven't found a good application for it. But I think from your description there, what I'm hearing is that there are, the realities of today are threaded into the future, and you're trying to figure how those threads play out.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's very easy to for people to say, hey, this thing is going to be big, and then not do the work to dimension how big and what being big is preconditioned upon. And so from the inception of ARC, you know, our intent has been to take the things that people say are going to be big and actually see how we can and can't sometimes successfully underwrite those futures. And so, you know, just like this year, we put out a cost decline in January of this year for the cost to train an AI neural net. And nobody had done that. And we think it's falling at a rate of 2.5 times per year, and that it's, we have strong, you know, quantitative reasoning behind and well-grounded assumptions that suggest it should fall 2.5 times per year on a go-forward basis through the end of the decade. And so, you know, the drama of GPT-3, which is a natural language processing model, it would have cost roughly $5 million to train it once when it was released. That falling to a $500 training event over the course of the decade is, it's clearly going to be meaningful in terms of the amount of innovation that happens in the AI space. And being able to, you know, say with some degree of certainty, hey, this is the direction that things are going, I think allows us to be more precise and discriminatory in terms of which technologies are reasonable to pay attention to and which are just not ready.
Mm. Did you call that Winton's Law?
No. Well, Winton's Law, what is it? I don't know if there's a Winton's Law. We use something called Wright's Law to tune all of our cost declines. And this is the idea that for every cumulative doubling of investment in a particular technology, it tends to fall at a consistent percent rate. I'd say Winton's Law is probably that people like to talk about things and not do the work. And you can actually generate a lot of insight by doing the work on medium-term technology shifts that often investors across different parts of the capital markets and venture public equities, you know, just try to like listen for what other people are talking about and say, oh, that must be the thing I need to get in front of. And I think it's very easy to get off sides of reality if you don't actually underpin kind of those things that you're excited about or want to be excited about with actual dimensioning of what the impact could be and over what time frame and how it makes sense or doesn't make sense as something to invest in as a tailwind. Mm-hmm.
I can't hear the title futurist without thinking about Arthur C. Clarke, who to my mind was verging on genius. In 1959, he predicted global satellites for TV broadcasts that in turn brought like infinite entertainment to anywhere in the world. He envisioned a personal transceiver so small and compact that every person would carry one. And he actually wrote, "The time will come when we'll be able to call a person anywhere on earth merely by dialing a number. Such a device would also include means for global positioning, so no one need ever get lost again." And as I'm sure you know, later then in his book Profiles of the Future, he predicted the advent of such a device taking place in the mid-1980s, which was absolutely unbelievable. And then in 1964, just to keep going, he described a global computer network on BBC's Horizon program, saying that by the 21st century, access to information and even physical tasks such as surgery would be accomplished remotely and instantaneously from anywhere in the world using the internet and satellite communication. So I think it's fair to say that for the most part, Arthur C. Clarke foretold with unbelievable accuracy the 50-year timeline of communications. What technologies do you see as defining the next 50 years? And what big milestones are you kind of watching for?
50 years is way too long at this point in technological development to actually successfully predict and underwrite. And that goes back to my original point that we're in the second half of the chessboard, meaning things are compounding so quickly that it really, I think, looking beyond a business cycle at this point technologically is massively challenging. And it's actually the fact that Arthur C. Clarke was able to make those calls over that time frame is indicative of how much time is compressing from an innovation perspective today. Because they're in artificial intelligence space. So first I'm going to limit the time horizon. My title may be futurist, but I think that going beyond a business cycle at this point, your error range on what's going to happen gets much wider than your ability to hit this, whatever the central tendency is. Over the course of this decade, what I can say is that future historians, I think, will look back on this business cycle and say, oh my gosh, artificial intelligence was at a critical stage of inflection and going essentially like a supernova in terms of the proliferation of tools and services that were being built on top of it and the enhancements to human capability that it provides. The electrification of drives, trains, and all mobility systems basically was happening within every context and sector. That multiomics or omniomics, we like to call them, the ability to read kind of the data that is contained inside your body and across your body and then operate on it and directly edit it and write it with synthetic biology was just hitting the sweet spot of being able to actually experiment and deliver treatments to inpatients. That the entire economic coordination function of cryptocurrencies was being adopted, you know, across multiple countries and displacing the existing world order of kind of fiat currency and changing the way capital markets work, and that kind of adaptive robotics powered by AI were, including reusable rockets, were kind of coming into the market and just changing the way in which we can manipulate the physical world and turning it into something that can be effectively software manipulated rather than hardware manipulated in a way that transformed economic activity, that future historians will look back and say, those five things were all happening at the same time. That's remarkable, amazing. This is the new technological boom, right? Mm. Like I think across all of those five areas I mentioned, we are at a stage of critical inflection where the cost declines are steep. They're cutting across sectors. They're themselves platforms on top of which other innovations can be built. And I think that moving beyond this business cycle and successfully trying to forecast it is incredibly complicated. You talk about it. You talked about chaotic math. It's because these platforms, you know, are intersecting and compounding in interesting and meaningful ways that make it hard to, you know, really say, you know, what is beyond this event horizon in a way that's, you know, is not totally unbelievable. And it's interesting to me. There is, in some ways, I think we're going to become guided by the vision that we have for humanity in a much more profound way than we have previously. Like, so Arthur C. Clarke laying out this vision of this is what technology can do, or Isaac Asimov laying out a vision of this is what technology can do, also informs the, you know, the entrepreneurs and investors in terms of this is the direction that technology should go. And so kind of like that envisioning of what's possible is important, particularly within the context of capital markets, where that controls and can guide how resources get allocated in terms of kind of causing things to develop. And so the kind of like interplay between the imagination or the depictions of what's possible technologically and the made realness of the technologies in the present is really fascinating to me.
But that's very higher order thinking. I mean, usually you try and force thinkers to go up to the 40,000 foot level. It feels you've gone outside the ionosphere there. So does that mean that your role as chief futurist is the way you think and assimilate and model data is different to when you were head of research for ARC? Like, have you gone from 40,000 feet into a reusable rocket and outside of the ionosphere?
No. I think that from the, you know, from the beginning and ongoing, our research has to and is extremely well grounded. And by grounded, I mean that the forecasts are justifiable and we try to skew them conservative. And then people look at it and say, these are insane, which, you know, it signals to us that there's market inefficiency in kind of the technological trends that we're underwriting. So, you know, when we first produced our published our electric vehicle forecast, EV volume forecast in 2017, we were in the teens, millions of units expectation. And at the time, the EIA thought it was a 200,000 to 300,000 unit market out through 2040. And people said, that's crazy. You know, there's only 100 million cars sold, you know, globally per year. And at the time, it might have even been 80. You know, how can you say that much of the market is going to shift over? And to me and to our team, it was obvious we had a good, well-tuned battery cost decline, which demonstrated that as kind of like the cost of vehicles starting at the high end drove battery volumes, you would continue that battery cost decline across the entire price segmentation spectrum of the motor vehicle market. And so it would be a great, close to that, not quite. I think it's 87 trillion is our official forecast. So that's on the basis of the cost decline that we've talked about, as in these systems are getting much cheaper to train, which implies that you'll be able to, as a software developer working with AI, build a tool for a knowledge worker. I consider you a knowledge worker. I consider me a knowledge worker that'll just make us more productive. Like, I don't know if you have ad reads in your podcast, but think about, you know, all of the poor podcasters who are out there having to read these ads in order to generate revenue for their podcast. And they do that because, you know, a host read ad is much more effective than like a third party ad that interrupts the podcast. But there's lots of inefficiency there. They have to record the ads over and over again. You can't like swap in advertisers as they change over or more easily promote an upcoming piece of content. So if instead you give an AI tool that can look at your, you know, written body of knowledge and read kind of like the copy that the advertiser wants to be read, but it comes out in your voice with a few kind of like, call it improvisations that a host read ad would do, but you don't have to come up with them because they're just within the context of your style. That allows that ad read, it allows podcasting as a whole to be a much more efficiently monetizable format. It allows the podcasters who are, you know, enjoying the conversation to spend less time like sitting in the booth being like, okay, now I have to advertise this underwear again. And it makes them more productive, right? Yeah. And so you extend that. So what we've done is said, like, given the rate change of AI, how is the productivity going to improve across all of these knowledge work categories? And we think that there's going to be a 2.5x productivity improvement for knowledge workers, meaning each knowledge worker will generate, you know, 150% more economic product than they were before. And that gets you to an expectation that, and then we don't think businesses are going to pay like the full amount for that productivity improvement, but instead, consistent with history, like they pay 25 cents for software that delivers them a dollar in ROI. And yeah. So all of that yields an expectation for AI software spend that exceeds $10 trillion by 2030. And I think it's 14 trillion is the official forecast. And then you need to invest in a lot of AI hardware to support that. And so you end up in the $14-15 trillion market for AI software and hardware. And so just for context, total global AI spend or IT spend today for all of the computers, all of the data centers, everything, it's on the order of 4 or 5 trillion. I think it's 4, right? And so we think that there's going to be a huge flood of spending into AI specific software and hardware, this is how we get to the 80 to 90 trillion in enterprise value accruable to AI hardware and software. But the reason we're going to spend on it is because it's going to generate all of this, you know, economic benefit and well in excess of what we're spending on it. And so and this is why I think forecasting beyond this cycle is hard, because our expectation is there's going to be a discontinuity in macroeconomic growth. effectively, that we're going, we're at, call it 3% real growth per year. And we think the exit rate in 2030 will be exceeding 7, maybe 8%, because all of these technologies are going to deliver huge macroeconomic improvements. And so the difference between the consensus forecast and ours in terms of GDP per capita is we think it's going to be 20,000 and consensus is 15. So imagine the entire world is like 30%+ richer than anybody anticipates over the course of this business cycle. That has, you know, it's huge human impact implications.
It's absolutely ginormous.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that, it's not, it's both consistent with long history and it's grounded by, like, I think a lot of kind of reasonable assertions about the direction that technology is going. And coupled with, you know, you should take a look at my Twitter feed sometimes, people think I'm crazy. They think it's totally wrong. They think there is no possible way this is right, that it's all smoke and mirrors, that actually this technological trend that you're talking about was just a flash in the pan as we were all suffering from the COVID fever dream, and it's you know, poof and gone. And yeah. I think that's it's certainly reflected in the prices in the market today, but I think it's wildly wrong and it's going to prove wildly wrong over the course of time. And so people will look back on, you know, this moment in market history and be like, what were they thinking that they were selling these assets at these prices? It's you know, massively backwards relative to the economic utility of the businesses that are going to deliver these advances.
Mm. But it's, you know, it's typical human condition to doubt a wild prediction. We really, as a creature, can only truly visualize something that we can see or experience at this moment in time. And it's the brave, such as yourself, who take a position on the future, which rooted back through proper modeling as with the best data you can get today. And I think it's you see it all the time. You go ahead and you say, well, I think the future will be ABC. And it's the easiest thing to do is to disagree. And that's why I think the best investors take a position, take a view of where the future is going to be and just stick with it and try and ignore the dissenting voices and the noise. You know, one of the questions that's we're on the subject of while we're on the subject of AI, it's a very simple question, probably difficult to answer, is like, when will AI outinvest humans? When will AI outinvest Warren Buffett? And will the owner, who will own that AI? You know, how is that, like, when eventually that AI system has been trained with vast amount of data, will that be open? Will it be closed? When will we look at Warren's approach as quaint? You know, where does the future of investing lie and the human edge that exists today when we look at AI?
You have to specify a time horizon over which that investment is occurring. You know, could I go up against the high frequency trading algorithm and win? No, I'd be like, you know, John Henry, I'd be run over by the train and it would be through the mountain before I even got to it. And so I think because markets are recursive, and the typical fault with quantitative investing is any arbitrage opportunity then gets filled and overfilled because there's a lag cycle between this is what's possible on the quantitative investing side. And then this is the frictional change in motivating capital into those quantitative models where it's like, yes, I've built a better mousetrap that can invest in the market, but now I have to turn around and convince the allocators that, hey, my mousetrap is better. And, you know, by the time they're all convinced, they're overconvinced. So there's competitors in the marketplace. So they all flood into, you know, whatever the newest quantitative algorithm is, which, you know, well exceeds the point where it was efficient within the actual market itself. And so I don't know that I think the recursiveness of the markets in terms of kind of allocating capital, I think makes them a particularly pernicious and challenging problem to solve over reasonable time horizons with AI.
Mm.
And I am loath to underestimate how capable artificial intelligence systems will get over any reasonable time horizon. I think that, you know, like since we put out this forecast on the cost decline that we're expecting in AI, which was January of this year, almost every incremental news piece that I've seen, not every incremental paper, has caused me to be like, ah, we were too conservative. I thought it was, you know, an extremely, certainly relative to what other people had published, this is a very aggressive cost decline expectation for these systems. And, you know, like more than twice Moore's law, actually almost three times Moore's law in terms of cost decline rate for training a neural net is our expectation. But there was just a paper published last week where Google used the same technique it used to beat the board game Go, which people, by the way, thought was like a solution that was two decades out when they published it, and suddenly it's best in the world. And so it's a system called reinforcement learning. They use the same agent and they just recontextualize the problem where you're no longer trying to learn how to win this board game. You're learning how to do matrix multiplication very efficiently. And matrix multiplication is a is kind of like the primitive math that lies at the foundation of all of these AI systems. And so they trained an agent to, on a general purpose basis, find extremely efficient ways to multiply matrices of different dimensions that previously was something that had to be kind of like a hand-tuned algorithm. Like, how can I multiply a 2 4x4 matrices in as few mathematical operations as possible? There's a 50-year-old heuristic that somebody had come up with for how to do that, and Google bested that. And bested not just that one, but basically produced a system that can make us efficient across all of the different matrix multiplies that we do. And so the fundamental math of AI has just become, you know, less computationally expensive because of this single AI advance across every single model. And so there's like the
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
The degree to which we are both improving the our understanding of these model architectures, which is then resulting in state-of-the-art output from these models, and using the models themselves to change the rate of progress, suggests to me that it's going to get wild in terms of capability, that things that, like, you know, we thought, oh, well, you know, maybe blue collar work is the first thing that's going to go. As it turns out, graphic artists are, they're not in trouble, but they better use these tools to be efficient at what they're doing, because, you know, I can create a picture of an artificial brain in an office that is constructed of cogs and wheels with like a cluttered shelf in the background just by typing that prompt into a text prompt. And I get a really interesting drawn thing that is unique to the world. It's never been seen by the world. And I'm not a good painter, right? And so previously I would have had to pay a painter to do that. Now I can just get it, not for free. It costs a few pennies, you know, and it costs my own time and creativity to produce it. And so the like set of things that are accessible through AI software, I think, is expanding in a really dramatic way. And we'll see. And so net of it, you know, how confident am I that you know, an AI system doing medium-term investing won't kind of like come into the marketplace and prove to be a really efficient way to deploy capital, certainly relative to traditional passive indexing? I don't know. You know, I think that there's a future in which it could enter that marketplace. And I think that the capital allocation game and the recursiveness of it and the degree to which it is gatekept and kind of like the frictional lags between actual efficient ideas with how to invest and the actual deployment of those investments within a set of institutions that they actually control most of the money is probably the call it fly in the ointment there. And so maybe it happens within the cryptocurrency and crypto asset space first. I think that would be a way that you could see it actually occur more readily.
It's fascinating. And before I move on to hit you with my standard closing question, I just want to ask you about the recent enough crypto gold rush, which for me reminded me that there's so many pretenders to a crown for any new technology. So with you, or rather with ARK and you and your process and your team, have you tweaked a radar for fakes? Do you have a process? Do you look at something and just the fact that you study it at such great depth, you can go, that's real, that's not real? Like, I just thought that for crypto, there was 29,000 ICOs over the last 3 years. You know, you got to look at 28,900 of them and go, fake. Is that just being a grown-up? Or is there a process that's more bedded down when in your investing life?
Well, I think that, you know, being able to underwrite technologies and securities and assets really requires an ability to be able to learn something and know when you've learned it. And I think a big part of that is also being able to teach something. And so one of the things that we do that's different from other asset managers is, you know, we're really transparent about our system of beliefs, and we try to publish the information that we generate internal to ARK. And, you know, we actually put out an EV forecast so you can hold us to account, and we explain how we get there. And being forced to understand something sufficient to explain it to somebody else actually, you know, immediately as you're trying to do that, highlights the places that you don't understand. And I think it's a good universal mechanism by which to really understand the things that you're investing in or not investing in. And a lot of the, you know, 28,990 ICOs were kind of like supported by white papers that weren't actually parsable. And that's like a good script. If you can't understand it, you can't invest in it. I don't
know. Yeah.
If you can get fooled into thinking you understand something because, oh, I'm going to gloss over this section because it's way too complex for me, but I'm sure they're talking about something important, then it's as likely that they're, one, like actually just BSing or not talking about anything important, or two, the person who wrote the white paper thinks they understand it, but they don't understand it either. And so I think that, you know, approaching things from a perspective of, is this something that we can understand sufficient to teach to somebody else to successfully kind of forecast and underwrite? It allows us to clip out a lot of, and is within a context where we think we have well-grounded, call it top-down or higher level understanding of what's going to happen in the market as a whole. So we already know that we probably have an edge in this area. That, you know, helps us dig in more fertile terrain. And, you know, I think that when you are investing in asymmetric markets, being too cynical is actually the wrong bias and stance. As in, you know, if you think if you can get 100x return paired with nine zeros, that's an amazing outcome. And so, you know, being able to dimension the potential and capability, you know, and this is true, this is particularly true in the venture space, but it's also true in public equities. I mean, I think that it's not, you know, was it certain that Tesla would be able to skate across its balance sheet as it was trying to produce the Model 3 when everybody was yelling at us that it was a zero? It wasn't certain, but it was probable. And, you know, I always thought they could come to market and sell more equity if they needed to, in order to fund themselves if they got that much in danger. But, you know, our dimensioning suggested if they did so, then there was a, you know, massively asymmetric return that was available there. And as it turned out, that at least as reflected in the marketplace today, that was true. And still again, you know, now that people say, oh, well, you know, robotaxi is too complicated, It's impossible. You know, Elon Musk says things that never come true, which, by the way, is actually doesn't stand up to the reality of the things they've delivered. But Robotaxi itself, we think, is two-thirds the net present value of Tesla. But I think that the actual investing marketplace treats it as a zero. So again, we think there's an asymmetric return contingent upon them, you know, delivering on the software that we think they're going to be capable of. And again, the marketplace clearly doesn't believe it. And so that's, you know, that's where you find opportunities by understanding something sufficient where you can, you know, really simply dimension it. Like for me, a red flag in our models is if the model gets too complicated, it embeds the ability to kind of cheat. You know, if you have like eight different inputs that you're using to get to a certain outcome, but all of those inputs have like a high degree of uncertainty around them that you get to tweak in whichever direction you want, then you end up in a spot where you can be in whatever outcome you want. And so then you might as well just say, I think this is going to be great, rather than trying to quantify it. And so a lot of the work that we do in, you know, underwriting an asset or underwriting a technology is in figuring out what is the minimum number of inputs we can operate with in order to successfully kind of underwrite and understand where this thing is going. And so then once you stripped it to the very simplest case, then you begin to get frustrated. It's like, well, do I know this is here? How can I like figure out what the error bars are around this particular input? And then you layer in complexity to help you understand the variance. But having that kind of like simple, distilled, almost like concentrated understanding of what's going to drive or kill a forecast, I think is both underappreciated and really important for operating over the time horizons that we operate over.
I couldn't agree more, actually. The market today is just soaked in disbelief for tomorrow's greatest companies. Like there is just a wet blanket of pessimism. And the reality, to kind of reflect back something you said, is that I think those optimistic thinkers with the right temperament currently are set up for future success. So Brett, I'm going to hit you with a closing question, which I hope you're allowed to answer. You're, in fact, you're allowed to say anything on this podcast. So you're allowed to answer it with me, but I don't know what's happening backstage at ARK. If you could only invest in five companies to hold for 10 years, as opposed to ETFs, what would you choose and why? I have to guess Tesla is one of them.
Sure. I mean, I you know, Tesla for sure. Like the idea there is, here is a company that has the largest deployed fleet of robots in the world. And actually the economic utility of those robots is going to massively increase if and as they deliver robotaxi capability to that deployed fleet, because the utilization will go up magnificently. And the utilization will go up because people will, you know, they may stay in the hands of private owners, but those owners will become operators of essentially taxi services. I think they're more likely to consolidate into like a series of, you know, think of them as franchises, and Tesla might even think that they're going to take them onto their own balance sheet themselves. But you go from a model of you're generating one-time operating earnings off a vehicle sale to you're generating ongoing operating earnings off the utilization of that vehicle in kind of a platform fee arrangement, the likes of which Uber or Lyft enjoys, but on a market that is, you know, 10 to 100x larger than Uber or Lyft, because you're operating at a price point that prices everybody in. Whereas, you know, if you ride in Uber for instead of buying a car, imagine you decide I'm just going to Uber the whole time because it seems convenient. That's the equivalent of buying like a $200,000 to $300,000 car. So not a lot of people can afford that, right? And so the change in the addressable market going from even $2.50 a mile to $1 a mile is a 10x change in the addressable market for point-to-point mobility. So,
and
yes.
Brad, here in Ireland, the cab driver is going to talk to you all the way there.
Well, I know.
The way back again. It's like, you know, you're not left alone with your thoughts. You have to talk to the guy. Okay, so Tesla number one. Give me a second one to buy and hold for 10 years.
Sure. I think that Roku is incredibly well positioned. So the way in which we consume and receive content is changing. And the you know, we're all familiar with this. Like, we no longer pay for TV, we pay for individual services, Netflix, HBO, et cetera. Well, as that transition occurred, kind of those companies left out a huge monetization slice of the market, which is basically ad-supported content. And the reason ad-supported content is important is because, you know, again, people like to get things for free or for effectively free. And so if you went all to direct pay, where I'm only allowed to watch something if I pay for it, you would actually reduce aggregate viewership because, you know, people want to pay with their attention as opposed to with their dollars. And so as the on-demand market shifts to an ad-supported model, that lends itself to there being like probably a couple or three like aggregation platforms that sit at that advertising layer. So we think that Roku is standing in front of kind of like the shift to ad-supported on-demand video in a profoundly interesting way where, and you know, the way in which the company is priced, it doesn't suggest that people believe that this is going to be a durable trend or that they're going to be able to use their monopoly position on distribution to take advantage of it. Whereas the what's interesting about advertising monetization is that it's a nonlinear kind of revenue generation engine relative to the size of your audience. So if you double your audience, you don't just get double the revenue, you get something like 4x the revenue. It's, I don't know what exactly the exponent is. And so it really heavily kind of drives the economics towards there being just a few aggregation platforms. And so, you know, helping kind of change the way in which content is consumed in that way, I think is how Roku sets itself apart. And previously the ability to be essentially a cable box was geographically constrained. Comcast is the ability to extend its tentacles is subject to the physical assets it has in place to stitch together households. And Roku can operate across geographies and across boundaries on that basis. And so, you know, all those call it cable box based businesses have been really nice cash flow generative businesses for a long time. But the world, you know, content is becoming a global business and Roku's position to be the front end of that global business.
Brett, you've nearly changed my mind on Roku. I have to hand it to you. That was convincing. Okay, hit me with number three.
Sure. You know, we are not on Zoom right now because this is some weird podcasting platform, but it's very clear to us that the world is shifting to basically video comms as the mechanism by which business gets done. And Zoom is both investing in companies that become verbs, I think, has historically been an incredibly good investing, rubric. And it's clear that Zooming is a verb. There's a whole generation named after Zoom.
And no AI system will ever cop that on, I'll tell you, Brett.
And being able to like legitimately connect with people. People talk about, oh, what's the metaverse strategy? What's the metaverse strategy? Facebook's idea is that we're all going to, you know, be kind of disembodied. Now we're going to have legs, but we're still going to be like these little cartoon things where our mouths are kind of like disjointed from what we're actually saying. And our hands are like little blocks that we swing around. Zoom is the enterprise metaverse. Like the degree to which people can, you know, make business connections, at least at the front end before kind of sealing the deal by going in person, is a massive productivity boost to enterprise. And I think it's clear that we are in a kind of remote or hybrid workforce world on a go forward basis. You look at, you know, San Francisco real estate, commercial real estate, there's 25% vacancy rate. There's a reason for that. It's because that, you know, it turns out it's more efficient to do some kinds of work remote and more efficient to do other kinds of work in person. And the set of enterprises that's going to compete for the crown and win are the ones that are going to figure out how to marry those two things. And to do that, you have to have, you know, your entire workforce on a modern comms platform. And so, you know, it's actually highly cash flow generative. It's treated as if all of the kind of strategic footprint they've built over the course of COVID doesn't actually accrue to their benefit, as if they've essentially fully saturated the market they're going to enter. But I think the next decade stands well to place it amongst the premier kind of enterprise platforms from a kind of distribution perspective, from a comms perspective, and from a how business gets done perspective.
Yeah, I agree with you fully. And in fact, recently became a shareholder for the first time. Hit me with number four, Brett.
Sure. So this is similar to Zoom, but Teladoc, this is in the Omics.
Oh, come on, you're kidding me. That's great news.
Yeah.
I lost my shirt in those, but I'm going to hold for another 10 years, see what happens.
Well, I think you don't have to survey many people to tell that kind of the U.S. health experience is remarkably broken. But the way to improve it is actually to create more touch points between primary care and patients in the U.S. And right now there's so much, both the monetization side of that and then the friction and getting a patient in front of a health professional is so high that it results in, you know, patients instead deciding I'm going to try to go direct to the specialist. And so then the oncologist, whose time is incredibly valuable, is, you know, the patient gets onto their calendar to talk about their fear that they might have cancer, you know, even if they don't like, so you actually have a lot of wasted resource around the fact that there's not a good intelligent front end experience for consumers in their healthcare lives. And so the clear mechanism by which to improve that is to provide the healthcare system with data and to use data to inform the way in which consumers go on their healthcare journey. And Teladoc as the front end provider for kind of consumers healthcare is well placed to do that. And then you combine that with kind of a shift to value based care, yes, by which they're getting reimbursed. So instead of, you know, that a lot of the health system in the US is on the basis of how many things do you do to the person, that's how much you get to charge. So you can understand what happens there. I go into the doctor, they're like, hey, we want to snip off this like little skin tag on your ear. That'll be $500 and it'll be reimbursable. And so then I'm like, oh, I guess so. You know, even though it's probably not something that should be insurance reimbursed, and the doctor advocates for it because that's how they get paid. You know, that's just the incentive misalignment is really, you know, doesn't lead to good outcomes. And so, you know, Teladoc has the data to deliver that they can, that they can deliver better health outcomes. And now kind of like the commercialization engine is set up for them to do so. And then one more thing I'd add is that the, you know, a lot of the noise in the marketplace has been on the basis of kind of venture-funded startups coming in and essentially using a loophole in regulations that opened up through COVID to prescribe, you know, ADHD meds and uppers to people over the air. And so that's like muddied the water in terms of kind of being able to actually deliver patients talk therapy efficiently, which Teladoc does without doing this kind of like pay for pill model over video. And so as that shakes through, and I think, you know, there will be a regulatory shakeout there likely on the startup side, or at least that rule will get unraveled. You know, that side of the business, which people have been focused on because it's the metrics are very easy to see, should wash out of the financials in a beneficial way.
Right, Brett, that was fascinating and a wonderfully comprehensive answer. So hit me with your fifth and final pick to hold for 10 years.
Sure. Coinbase.
Coinbase is... Now, that's surprising to me.
Is it? Well, first of all, I mean...
Well, firstly, I haven't done deep research on Coinbase, Brett. I looked at it long enough for me to just have an aversion. And that aversion was based on the fact that the crypto state of play hasn't stabilized to a point where I believe that the business model for Coinbase is certain. Now, I know its financials are good, but I have not looked at where, I haven't taken a view of where it's going to be in 10 years. And I have it like inextricably connected to the heat that was in the general crypto space 18 to 24 months ago. So when that cooled down, and as a self-proclaimed doubter of not crypto, but crypto as a... at the volumes at which we were seeing, for me, it was analogous to the dot-com bubble. In 1999, there was tens of thousands of web businesses, of which 90-something percent were eradicated. At that point, I looked at Coinbase and said, yes, they are the leader in their field, but their field is still in total disarray. So I stood back and just left it there. In fact, of the five stocks you've discussed, the one I'm least qualified to go deep on is Coinbase. So I'm going to shut up and hand it over to you.
Well, first of all, there's a tailwind in cryptocurrencies and crypto assets. I think that, you know, the revolution in money that Bitcoin is, I think, going to dominate is going to be one of the defining macroeconomic developments of this age. That, you know, if you think about it, the fact that there are hundreds of currencies out there because of the lines that we draw on maps is really economically inefficient and in some ways bizarre. And there's strong kind of market pressure to erode kind of the monopoly on money that polities have. And you don't need to make aggressive assumptions about the degree to which that changes in order to underwrite a very high price appreciation for Bitcoin itself. Within the smart contracting space, which I see as a totally separate revolution that was catalyzed by the introduction of Bitcoin into the marketplace, but where it's unlikely that Bitcoin will play a primary role. And, you know, maybe it's Ethereum, maybe it's, you know, the other level one that are being positioned out there to kind of provide that future. But it's clear to me that kind of digital ownership and smart contracting is going to spit off a whole slew of business models and change the way in which financial operations happen in the economy. And so you combine those two tailwinds. I think our official forecast out there is you're going to have on the order of $40 trillion in attributed value to blockchains by 2030, up from, I don't know where we are today, but I think we're around a trillion less probably. And so you have the realization of all of that economic value is going to create a layer of service providers or create the opportunity for layers of service providers to facilitate people's use of and exploitation of those two simultaneous revolutions. And because of the nature of the crypto protocols, it lends itself to actually much more vertical integration than currently exists within the financial services entity. And so you can think of Coinbase as being a combination between the kind of like the investment bank and the exchange and the custody agent and potentially providing kind of like ongoing, call it asset management services or, you know, if staking as a service in some way is, you know, helping to secure the networks and then take a platform rent for doing so. And so the kind of like combined set of services that Coinbase can provide to the market, I think is going to be very economically valuable. The counter arguments to Coinbase is that, hey, they're generating an abnormally high fee relative to trading volume and that fees are going to come under compression because of all the competition from FTX and Kraken and everybody else who's trying to do this stuff. And so then, you know, yes, their financials look good today, but they're going to look bad tomorrow. Actually we've underwritten the position with like a really aggressive fee compression expectation. But the rate of growth in the underlying market and their ability to kind of innovate and deliver, you know, much needed kind of UI improvements to the end consumer to allow them to access these technologies and actually use them in their daily life is what drives the investment case.
Brett, five fantastic ideas there and wonderful answers. And I think thank you very much for spending so much time and being so selfless with your knowledge this afternoon. And I'm looking forward to speaking to you again soon.
All right. Cheers. Thank you much, Emmett.
Thanks, Brett. Bye-bye.
Bye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.